Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast. My name is Stacey Ramsauer, and I'm your host. This is an ongoing conversation about the sacred nature of embodiment and the path toward greater fulfillment as humans. We approach this conversation from the lens of birth, food, intimacy, sex, and much more. I hope you enjoy, and I'm so glad you're here. Welcome to the Sacred Body Podcast. Today is really special for me because my guest is sort of the spark for me that shifted the trajectory of my work and my offering in the world. So I feel really honored to welcome Kimberly Johnson to the podcast. Kimberly is an author, a single mom, a teacher, without comparison in my experience, and a really prolific voice in the world of women's health. And I think for me, the most interesting voice when it comes to having sane, intimate relationships and a wonderful sex life. So I'm excited to dig into all of the things. And Kimberly, I just want to thank you again for being here, for making time, for being so generous with yourself and your wisdom. And if you could just touch on any of the things that I didn't say that you're most excited about in your offering right now, and we'll get the conversation started there.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And yeah, I mean, there's so many like little branches on the tree trunk, but I think you kind of got the tree trunk down, and I'm sure that we'll get into it as we go. You know, I mean, what's forefront of my mind is at the moment is that I wrote a book called The Fourth Trimester, and then I just released cards that are called The Fourth Trimester Cards, and then I just turned in a journal that goes with those two, so that kind of body of work. And then also I'm working on some projects to help people heal from a difficult birth, because I love Pam England's work on birthright medicine, and I love somatic experiencing, and I'm a somatic experiencing practitioner. But I found that there's just so much that happens in birth that this is a rich territory for us moving forward in identity, and I want more people to have access to it. So I'm just always trying to brainstorm and elaborate ways on how more people can get access to things that have seemed really specialized.
Yeah, that's something I find really special about somatic experiencing and other threads from that work that extend off from that work, just the somatic work in general, that it puts so much power, for lack of a better word, back in the hands of the person who's experienced an event. And, you know, without kind of belaboring this description of what is somatic experiencing, I think we have a lot of informed listeners here, but this, it's like the nexus for all of these specialized areas of work, really just, and that's something so special for me about the way that you teach and what you teach, is that you touch on so many different things, but it never seems, they don't seem like disparate parts, right? There's a very clear intersection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because people always reflect that back to me, like, well, you do so many things, because I hate hybrids of stuff. Like, people are always like, oh, you would love, you know, pie yoga, like some Pilates yoga thing. And I'm like, no, trust me, I would hate it. Or like yeah, you would love yoga dance because you love yoga. And I'm like, no, really, I would actually really, like, that's my version of personal health. Like, I would like to go to a dance class, or I would like to go to a yoga class. And I actually don't, I think you would love an ecstatic dance. No, I actually don't. I don't like being in a room with, like, kind of bad music and, like, obscure boundaries and, like, weird dancing. Like, I just, it's not my thing. I totally get why people like it. But when people tell me, oh, you do, like, so many different things, I see why they're saying that, but it doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like I do, yeah, it just, the relationship between them feels like super clear to me. But I understand looking from the outside, if you're trying to look at like what all my credentials are or what schools I've been to or those kinds of things. Live out of habit. So everything that I've ever taught since I started teaching is about helping people feel the truth of the present moment outside of conditioning. Mm-hmm. And so every single thing that I offer is in service of that, whether that's a movement class or the breath collective I'm a part of or a session. It's when you work in the world of trauma, like, which is so popular right now, and I'm like pulling my hair out every single day watching incorrect graphics being made about polyvagal theory, and people get real protective of their traumas, and I found that a lot of people, because we all want to make meaning of our lives, and that's part of being a human, and we're at a real specific point, I think, where a lot of people have a little bit of information, and there's a temptation, especially if your own system is highly sensitive or you consider yourself empathic or you are dysregulated, frequently chaotic, maybe you grew up with alcoholism in your family, there's a temptation to want to do that as a career or to dedicate yourself to that, and which just allows you to swim in that vortex even more. And it's really shifted, like, since I went to school, because I started in 2011, but I also started in Brazil. And in Brazil, it's, like, more like the States was maybe 10 or 15 years ago with SE, even though SE, somatic experiencing, was in Brazil really early on. Here, it's really been co-opted into the mental health realm. So, like, MFTs, licensed clinical social workers, there's a lot less people coming from the bodywork side than there used to be. It used to be kind of half and half. There's just this, we all have to go through a stage where we understand, like, instead of slapping ourselves with the privileged label and telling ourselves we shouldn't feel as bad as we do or why aren't we getting over something, we all have to go through a stage where we really acknowledge that what we've experienced has had its own unique imprints on us. And we also all have, I believe, the responsibility to stop defining ourselves by those moments and be willing to loosen the grip of those, you know, in yoga we call it vasanas, but I just think of it as like little knots in our system. And what I see now is just this, especially probably among the people that are listening, and everybody wants to be a spiritual teacher. Everybody, I mean, I'm like, I don't understand why everyone wants to be a spiritual teacher. It's a really hard job. And everybody wants to be the healer, which is, I mean, it's a wonderful intention. But the thing that we have to see is, like, are we swimming in that meme? Because that meme is just reflecting in our own internal state, and that we actually just don't have capacity for joy or creativity or aliveness that would be like actually our real dharmic expression, rather than getting caught up in the, you know, maelstrom of activation.
I feel that really personally. I feel that. And I think what you said about, you know, putting ourselves in positions where it just allows us to swim in the patterning of our system. I'm curious about your thoughts on the role that social media is playing in this, where it's like you have to, everyone has at least gotten an email checklist how-to of like how to build your brand, and it fixes us like that. It's like, here's a way to create something. I think the intention really is, here's a way to create something good in the world, but often playing to my need to be liked and desire to be really needed by someone else. And it creates a real rigidity. It can create a real rigidity in the body and the mind. And I just love to know, I'd love to hear you riff on that, particularly because you are so visible in that medium. But there's so many things I want to talk to you about regarding that. I find you to be really fluid there. So take it away. Share your thoughts.
Okay, so, well, first of all, one thing that people need to understand is that the amount of followers that you have doesn't have anything to do with the kind of business that you have.
Mm-hmm.
So I have friends who have 2,000 followers and are making multiple six figures a year, and you wouldn't be able to tell that based on what their profile looks like. And then I know people who have 125,000 followers and they're not making any money.
Yeah.
So the appearances is just like sexuality. Somebody can look super sexy and talk the talk, and yet when you actually have a conversation, they've never had an orgasm and they don't know how to do anything except for one kind of relating, right? So we can't tell by appearances. And I guess I must just have an oppositional personality style, because since I've been like 13 years old, whenever I've looked at anything on the media or magazines, I've just always automatically looked at it and been like, that's not real. Like, I've never really gotten into a comparative thing of like, why am I not skinny like the supermodel? It's just like, oh yeah, there's that person with that one body type, and that's what that thing is about. So for me, that lens is just always in front. It's probably also from growing up in Southern California, where everyone's had plastic surgery and it's totally normal. And so I can tell right away if someone has had plastic surgery. It's like so easy. Like, and people will be like, really? And I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, nope. Like, yes, really. So I just tend to have that as a strategy, I guess, of just like always knowing that what you see is not what you get.
Mm-hmm.
With a lot of people. I think what people relate to in terms of my social media, and you can tell me if I'm right because I am the one doing it, I'm not the one watching it, is, and the way that I felt comfortable doing it has been, I do just a lot of improvisational content. So where I get tight is if I have to pre-record something and that I have to get a point across that's like what marketing tells you you have to do, which right. is like have 3 points and make sure it's not too long and make sure it's not this and make sure it's not that. I'm just not a perfectionist when it comes to that. So my vanity, I'm not really also that vain about it. It's just kind of like, I do it unless I like end out way out in left field, I might just like delete it or something. But that's what allowed, if I would have had to do pre-recorded content where I looked a certain way, I wouldn't have gotten anywhere because I started out by just doing Facebook Lives.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's true to my personality, because my personality is that I believe that I can always change my mind. So I don't believe that when I say something, and people always think that I'm much more definitive than I actually am. So my communication and expression comes across as like very, like I know this, but on the inside, like I'm a 6 on the Enneagram. I'm self-doubt. I'm like filled with doubts. I double back on myself. But as far as communication, I'm like, if someone were to say, like, you said this, some of the time I don't remember saying it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the time I'm like, really? Oh, well, I don't think that anymore. I just am like, this is what I think for now. And the same thing goes, you know, a lot of people are held back in their communication because, or like writing, they don't want to make other people look bad. So they're afraid of making their mom look bad, or they're afraid of making their partner look bad, or they're afraid of making their, they don't want their kid to be out there, whatever. I have a few rules with that where, like, I ask Cece before I post something about her and my daughter. I've taken something down one time that I posted about my mom. Well, actually, two times. One with my mom because she asked me to, and it wasn't worth it to me to keep it up. And then another was with Cece wanted me to take a post of her dad down because at first she was okay with it, but their relationship changed and she just didn't want it there anymore. Mm-hmm. So that was fine. But otherwise, I believe everyone has a right to their own story. So just because I have my story doesn't mean my mom doesn't also have her story. And if she wants to get out there and tell her story, she's welcome to. It's not on me that she's not into that. You know what I mean? So I don't think she's a bad person because of our dynamics. I just know that I'm a daughter, and from my perspective, this is how I feel. And I have a right to that. Just like she has the right to feel some other way about it and also have her version of the story. So,
well, it's so much, like, there's something really powerful in there that, because also of your background, and I feel like a lot of the people who are drawn to you do have a similar background with healing or yoga, or, you know, have experienced a relational rupture, trauma from a teacher. And there is this pervasive belief within the spiritual realm that I really dislike about, like, you can't say anything negative. And so it's like there's a lot of convincing ourselves that what happened didn't happen, or it wasn't as bad as it was, or, you know, just a lot of shoving down feelings of anger or rage or grief. And there is something truly liberating in the work that you offer, and it's from the way that you are in the world, which is, I'm allowed to have my story. It's okay to say this, and in the event that it does do harm to someone, I'll double back, I'll reconsider, I'll engage in a conversation, but my experience is valid. And that's such a huge part of the puzzle when it comes to expressing ourselves sexually. Like, I can change my mind. I don't have to be fixed in this way of wanting or expressing or receiving. And I think that's radical for most people.
Sure. Yeah, I lately I've been saying this a lot, so I kind of question myself, but the more, like, I just picked up the Gia Tolentino book, Trick Me or Tino about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she's in her early 30s, maybe like 31 or something. And there was another article that recently came out in The Cut, written by, in The Cut or in New York Magazine, super smart, by this woman who, and Gia too, like, they started online at like 10, right? Which might be your experience. Mm-hmm. It's definitely Cece's experience. And I'm a Gen Xer, so I'm 45. And sometimes I feel like people are like comparing themselves to me in a lot of different ways. That's like, I have a lot of training because I'm old. And I say that, like, you know, I've just been around 10 more years, 15 more years than you have. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot more life there. And age doesn't always mean wisdom, or, you know, experience doesn't always mean wisdom, but I actually didn't grow up online. So I didn't grow up taking selfies. I didn't grow up thinking about how I was going to present my experience before I even had it, right?
Yeah.
That, like, the reflection of that or the posting of that is what makes it real. I'm just as susceptible to everyone than as everyone to the addictive nature of it. I mean, all of our brains are susceptible to that. But I think the most difficult, contentious part is, number one, the difference between you and your business. So women have notorious challenges separating what is me and what is my business. So when things aren't right in our business, we blame ourselves and say, like, I should do this, I should do that. But it's actually a business model difficulty. And the social media thing makes that even harder to tell. which, you know, I'm not like the first person to say this, because it's like, it's mm-hmm. the quintessential dilemma of a personal brand. But from the inside, I remind people a lot in my life, in case you think I love making videos, I just want you to know that actually I would much rather be going for a walk, reading a book I like, you know, making out. I do these because they make me money,
mm-hmm.
period. And that's not true for everyone. Not everyone making videos is making money from them. It's true for my business model, and it's trackable. So I think that's one thing that people aren't thinking about either, is because this whole thing about, you know, for 15 years, people have been saying content is king. But guess what? There's a lot of people spinning their wheels, generating content and content and content and content, and they're just measuring success by likes. And there's not really a tangible outcome that they have to measure. Whereas in my business, I can actually tell when I record something if sales go up or down,
yeah.
when I'm in a sales cycle, right? So there's a strategy behind it, and you can still be real, right? Like, I mean, I'm a person who hated selling. I'm a person who was just like, hated the word marketing, mm-hmm. was just like disgusted by the idea of like selling yoga. How could I, how could anyone? So I lived in India with my guru. We were alone, enchanted in Tiruvannamalai, and I never once paid 1 cent to my guru. Not monetarily, but I sure got my money's worth otherwise. So, you know, I've been there. And now for me, the reconciliation is that I'm just always teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I, in a sales cycle, I used to feel like, oh, that's so cheesy to like post more. And like, that's, I'm using people and this and that. But now I look forward to sales cycles because it gives me energy to put out really good information, so that even if people don't buy something, they've actually still learned something. Mm-hmm. And I've given them a lot of value anyway. And that's what any coach would tell you, but it didn't really make sense to me until it felt authentic to me in that way, that it felt like that's just actually what I'm doing. I'm actually creating imagery that I like with artists that I like, and I'm creating a narrative that goes along with this imagery, and that feels satisfying to me no matter if I'm selling something or not.
What shifted for you? Because I know you shared something that was really, again, resonant for me about kind of this life cycle of, you know, somehow the money just ended up being there by the end of the month, and there was a really significant shift for you. And I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, certainly the launch of your book made a difference as far as visibility, but there was a lot beyond that. And I know that Me Too really launched your dialogue in a different way. And I know I'm naming a lot of different things, but what shifted for you as far as feeling really authentic in your sharing and meeting it with enthusiasm versus a little bit of like, I don't know, I feel kind of like this heaviness around it sometimes.
It's hard to pinpoint one thing, because there's been so many turning points in my business mm-hmm. over the past 10 years. But I'd say one of the biggest things is just that, and again, this is advice that you get everywhere about like trading time for money. But when I got saturated in my one-on-one practice doing internal work, and frankly, it was pretty physically exhausting for mm-hmm. me. Like, I don't have the constitution to be doing 20 sessions a week, if anyone does, but like, I definitely don't. And realizing that all of these memes that you hear about like reach and stuff, that just felt very abstract to me. And I was so connected to how great the results that I was getting were one-on-one, and yeah. how specialized my skills were. But when it got to the point where it was like, I can't see this many people, like, it's just, I can't keep doing it. And I gave myself even the like window to say, okay, I'm going to take a 3-month sabbatical from this. It was like prioritizing myself.
Mm-hmm.
you know, prioritizing myself and my family and not feeling like I had to sacrifice and be in that sacrificial mode. And basically what I was saying earlier, that like, it's okay to have space. It's okay to enjoy what I'm doing. It's okay for it to feel a little bit easy instead of I have to do it. I have to do everything, which was kind of an old habit, because when I was an early single mom, I did have to say yes to everything. I did have to, that's how I was making ends meet. And so as far as the sharing goes, though, I mean, that really just started when I wrote the first article that I ever wrote in Elephant Journal, which was about, it was like a three-part story about my experience with my guru. And I think that was kind of when I broke the silence, so to speak, of writing the thing that I thought I shouldn't write about and that felt dangerous for me to write about. And then once I did that, and I wrote a couple other articles and wrote this blog, Recovering Yogi, that's not around anymore, but was also like, one was called Please Don't Call Me Spiritual. They were like snarky but smart articles that were like critical of the spiritual world. Then I think I kind of said, okay, I am going to talk about the things that are important to me. And I'm not giving a clear answer because I'm not sure if we're really talking about business or we're talking about like how I came to be comfortable in a selling position. But what I, over and over when I'm talking to people, it's really about knowing yourself and knowing what is the avenue for you. So for instance, it would be like really smart for me to make some YouTube videos, like great, high attraction, high search engine, like, you know, really like from a rational point of view, that would be really smart. But I just don't want to do it. And like the only way that I would do it is if I had like a production team and it was like there was days set aside and people were like had a schedule and they were telling me the schedule, because then I would just show up and do it. But otherwise, it's just not. I already have too many channels that I'm in with the amount of support that I have. So I see women saying like, well, I need to do this and I need to do that and I need to do this. But it's like, the question is kind of, what will you do? So for me, what I would do was like just hop on a Facebook Live and talk for a while. And yeah. Then, you know, that was before Instagram. Choose a topic and talk about it. And like, oh, people are listening. Okay. And then people would refer back to things and I would be like, oh, okay, so that's helping someone, so I'll just do it again.
And based on response, getting a little more specific about what the need is or what the, I mean, it's sort of as your offerings, I feel like your offerings have met the need of your audience a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's that sweet spot. It's and that's something that I think is kind of special about me, is that I can hear the, like, and when I see it in other people too, like I can just feel the bell tone and I know when it's off. So I feel bad for people sometimes because I see what they're doing and I'm like, that's not going to work. And I'm usually not wrong.
Yeah.
So I don't really know how that is, but it's just like I've learned what my bell tone is and I can just feel when something's like a little bit off. And so it has to be the perfectest meaning, synchronous, I guess, between what's alive for me and what I really want to talk about and then what people really want, right? Because a lot of people are just putting out something that's like, that's what they think is important.
Yeah.
And it very well may be important, but they haven't verified that other people think it's important in the same way that they think it is. Because any given thing that you offer, and really anything, let's say a postpartum cookbook or how to put together a postpartum plan for pregnant people, something like that. You could call it 12 different things and it would mean something totally different, but the product itself could be the same thing.
Yeah.
You could call it how to avoid postpartum depression. You could call it how to make sure you have sex ever again after you have a baby. You know, you could call it anything.
Yeah.
And it's the same actual thing. But what people do is they describe the thing that they're doing. So I'm going to offer how to make a postpartum plan. Okay, well, that's great. But like 3 people ever in the world had that thought. So you have to tell them, because that's the teaching part that people think is selling. And they think it's cheesy, but it's not. It's actually just, this isn't about you. It's actually about the other person. And I think that took me a long time to really get, and I resisted it as a yoga teacher specifically. Like, mm-hmm. I just did not want to, quote unquote, dumb it down. And like, I just didn't want to teach about like low back pain. You know, I'm just like, I'm not a pathologist, and like, I don't fucking care about people's back pain, you know. But I got over it, and the first online class I taught was a class on low back and neck care with Yoga Body Naturals like 7 years ago. And we had like a bunch of people from all over the world. That's kind of what showed me. There's like a guy from Tunisia and a guy from Uzbekistan. And I was like, wow, this is incredible, because these people actually don't have access to this. So yeah, that it's like finding the sweet spot, like the vessel of expression. You have to know if it's writing for you, if it's videos, if it's, you know, if YouTube really is your jam. If you're like, I hate Facebook, then don't do, like, I'm not on LinkedIn, and authors are supposed to be on LinkedIn. Yeah. I'm not on there. Like, I don't like it. I mean, Twitter. I'm not on either. Mm. I might be on LinkedIn, but I never, my profile's outdated.
It's only because you have a Gmail account.
Yeah. Twitter is supposed to be the thing that authors are on, but mm-hmm. I'm an author and I'm not on it. So maybe my publisher in the future will tell me to be on it. I don't know, but it doesn't matter, because there's no point in having an account that you don't use anyways.
Right.
And energetically, I was just talking about this morning about affiliates. So everyone tells me I need to have an affiliate program. That's the next step for my business. Da 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 da. Okay, great. Guess what? I recommend things all the time. I recommend people. I recommend programs. I recommend books. And never once have I done that because I'm an affiliate. There have been times when I've had an affiliate link because I interviewed that person and then that's the link they gave me. But I didn't want it necessarily, actually. They're like, that's just the one they gave me.
Mm-hmm.
And people can feel the frequency of that. They know that I'm not talking about this thing just because I have a secondary gain in mind, that I hope that they're going to buy that thing. And they can feel that.
Yeah.
And that's, for what I do, that's important. I mean, I think that's important for many people, but specifically dealing with trauma and boundaries and consent and transparency, that's important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I rely on other people doing the same for me. Or not, or just do, you know, like last year I started working with the Facebook ads person. So that was the step that I chose instead of choosing to do affiliates, which I, you know, someone said in the future I have to do it. So we'll see. I mean, nobody has to do anything, but it has to be. For me, that's why I know why I am where I am, because it rings true to people.
Mm-hmm. And it really does. It really comes through, and I can see it. I've experienced it. You ring as trustworthy, and it's not like the way that I think a lot of teachers create that, which is like, you can tell me anything and come and rest your head on my chest and that kind of thing. It's not saccharine. It's not a need from you. It's more like, you know who you are through and through, and you're not going to offer something that isn't 100% true for you, even if it's momentary. And that's safe. And you speak a lot about safety and boundaries in your work. That's, you know, in my experience, the crux of it. And you shared something in a newsletter that's like my favorite quote ever now, like, lemon water in morning pages is not my process. And I was like, fuck yes, that's so wonderful. And I would love to hear you speak to this tendency in most people, but particularly good little yogis, yoginis, like I'm going to perfect my morning routine and I'm going to perfect my daily attendance of whatever and I'm going to be perfect. And this need to kind of feel like there is an external guarantee for our process and our experience, which there just isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not a ritual person. I love rituals, but I'm not a daily person. And, you know, one of those lines, like what you were saying, the lemon pages and morning water, lemon water and morning pages, is also, I heard, the woman who wrote Wild, Cheryl Strayed, speak, and she was talking about how she's a binge writer, and so, like, she needs to write, and then she just rents a hotel that's really close to her house, like, the closest one she can go to, so that she can just be somewhere else and be writing. And it was so liberating for me, because everything that I heard was, like, you have to, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert, she sits down every day at 9 o'clock, and she writes, and that's how it goes for her, and she has to do that, and, you know, at bird, anything you read, bird by bird, and, you know, it's all about, like, it's your practice. Of course, there was a time in my life when I practiced yoga every day, and I usually practice at the same time, and I practice for a few hours, so I don't want to discard that, because I think for a certain time in my life, that was, that allowed me to be how I am now.
Yeah.
From a chaos theory perspective, or where I learned about it in organic intelligence with my teacher, Steve Hoskinson, is like, you know, we start off in chaos, most of us, our systems, and then that's like phase one. And phase two is these practices that help us start to feel a sense of regulation and tools. But I just see so many people are stuck there. And the third, or, you know, the next phase is, so is organic intelligence, rhythmicity, so that metronomic rhythmicity is our true nature. It's actually, it's where our system wants to live. And instead we get stuck with all of these, like, that's why I can't stand all of the, like, biohacking breathwork stuff, like your breath's your remote control. So, like, oh, I'm anxious. Okay, hold on. Gonna do an exhale retention here and see if I can, oh, I'm feeling depressed. Hold on, inhale retention. You know, it's just like, it's so prescriptive. And I understand. And like I said, I went through a long time where I was using practice as self-regulation and I didn't really realize that's what I was doing. And, you know, arguably it is better than psych meds. For me, it was. But at the same time, there just comes a time when there's something else that's happening that needs to be attended to so that we can get to this state of flow, or, you know, a wider margin that doesn't require that we're constantly managing symptoms.
Right.
That there's an absence of symptoms, or there's an absence of over-identification with the symptoms, and always being that, you know, I talk a lot in Jaguar about this, is that, you know, when yoga practitioners, meditators, creatives, a lot of the time, there's so much inward focus, you know, and we love talking about our inner work, and we just need to do our inner work. And I'm like, really? I think you need to, like, look up and look around a little bit.
Totally.
And, like, see the view, like, what's around you. And there's an overemphasis of how important it is to look inside. The answers are all inside. This emphasis on, you know, I really can change the world. I can't change the world until I change myself, and I've got to hyper-analyze every part of my own process to do that. And I find that, like what you were saying about social media, is I would say probably people do have a perception that I'm vulnerable on social media, but I don't of course you know what you can say. It's like, it's the same thing as teaching yoga. Like, you know what you can do to make people emotional. It's really fucking easy. Like, keep people in standing poses for like 3 minutes, or put them upside down and tell them they can't come down. You know, I mean, it's easy to push buttons. It's harder to get people down off those activation edges and to be content in a margin where their system's not just getting hammered with activation. Because we're, look at how many people want to be doing ayahuasca, like, and if ayahuasca is not enough, then let's get combo. And if that's not enough, then just like up the ante, up the ante, up the ante, instead of like, can we feel satiated? Can we feel contentment with where we are? And of course we shouldn't feel satiated or content if we're in dangerous situations or, there's a reason that we're not feeling that way some of the time. But I just, as far as, you know, when I was doing PR for the book the first time, it was like every interview they looked, because it was like mostly in beauty and health and stuff, everybody wanted to know like my skincare routine. Yeah. And I'm just like, dude, if I just get up in the morning and like wash my face or like look in the mirror before I go out of the house, like that's a good morning for me. Like, to get up, make my daughter lunch, make her breakfast, make sure she's a modicum of dressed, do all, like, that's pretty good. And like, no, am I lighting my Palo Santo and like saying mantra? No. But again, and I realize that I'm coming from a point of view, because sometimes I honestly forget. There was a time in my life where I was devoted and dedicated and disciplined. And it wasn't a discipline of like rigidity. I really loved it. So I wanted to be in the yoga studio all the time. I had that relationship with dance. So I was used to going to a studio to be in movement together with other people. And so I wasn't hyper driven. It was actually like really what I wanted to do. But it was also because there was a deep underlying need to feel better than I was feeling. And that's the only thing that I knew helped, because even therapy at the time wasn't really helping. And I didn't know how dysregulated I was until now that I'm not so dysregulated anymore. When I look now, I just moved back to New York. I lived here 20 years ago. I was really dissociated when I lived here before. And being back here makes me realize, like, wow, like I remember where I worked. I mean, of course I remember, but like, I remember the feeling of it. I walked by the street and I remember the feeling of what it was like when I went to the job, and like just how much of a shell of myself that I felt like. But I didn't know the degree to it until now that I feel so much in myself and settled in myself.
And I think that's a hard thing for anyone to be able to imagine, when there is such a strong connection of relief to the practice or the act. And I love this conversation so much, because we get any addiction, whether it's to alcohol or it's to a yoga practice, there is a reaching for relief. And, you know, I think without leaving room for someone to think that I'm saying being addicted to alcohol or drugs is a good thing, I think there's a process to it, and hopefully we find our way beyond something that is destructive. But I also do think some of our physical practices can be really destructive. And with this kind of moving beyond the rigidity of the introspection, you know, for me, what that lit up was this limitation on how and who we're able to relate to when we're like so fixated on our inner experience and the inner process. It means often that the only people we can relate to are those who are like mirroring back our exact experience, which is not a healthy relationship. It's also not a healthy community. It's also not reality. And it's a lot of what's happening right now in the world.
Yeah, I think I would feel guilty about this conversation if I didn't feel I had some real solutions beyond like offering people one-on-one sessions. Because just pointing out the ways that things doesn't work isn't exactly helpful.
Yeah.
And I know for some people, they're like, yoga, a lot of people have the story, you know, yoga saved my life. And I just want to say that, you know, like in the Jaguar course, there's just some fundamental tools that you can learn that are, yeah, they're tools, but they're also foundational parts of personhood that we didn't get when we were younger, most of us. And so when we recognize what those principles are, we can apply them in a lot of different situations so that there's not such a separation also between what's relational and what's spiritual. Because I think part of the thing is that philosophies like yoga or Buddhism, people, you know, because we're already working with difficulties and differentiation, we tend to go to those models and then think that those models should be able to address anything, right? Like, I mean, I really think that in my younger days, I thought that yoga, there wasn't a problem that yoga, some part of yoga couldn't solve. I really thought that. I mean, I think it made me a good teacher because I was unwavering from feeling like, oh, well, then you just don't know this other branch. Like, let me, like, for sure yoga can do this. And this underlying organismic intelligence is something that then you can go to practice and it can be something completely different. It can be like, I mean, I have no idea who I would be had I been doing 25 years of yoga already with a stable nervous system. It's and these practices in general are made for a stable ego structure. That's why there's so much talk about destroying the ego, because the assumption is that the ego is already there and stable. Whereas in fact, most of the people drawn to the practice don't have a stable enough ego structure to manage it, to have it deconstructed first. And again, that's like this perspective that there's something wrong. There's something wrong with us. There's something wrong with our ego structure. There's something wrong with the way, with our story, quote unquote story, and how that registers in each system is different, like within each body, within each makeup. So I think that we are evolving, and I don't just think, it's obvious, look at what's happening. There's like exposés just all over the place about how power has played out within systems of spirituality and yoga, that we really miss this relational piece.
I've heard you describe your first book, The Fourth Trimester, as your soul's work. And I'm curious if there's a simple way that you would describe your second book, which is based on the Jaguar Course. Is that a correct way to describe it?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's also my soul's work. Yeah.
An extension, a progression, or...
Yeah, I mean, it felt like the fourth trimester was something that I had to do, which is one of the reasons I call it my soul's work, because it was like I kept trying not to do it, and it wouldn't let me go. So I even put it away for like a year, and then I had a tarot reading, and the tarot reader was like, you've got some big project that's like sitting in a drawer and you need to do something with it. And I'm like, oh my gosh. And I even said to people, like, maybe I'm not meant to do it, right? Like, because if it's not, if nothing's happening with it and I put all this energy into it, like, maybe it's just not meant to be. I feel like I wrote that book, and when I read it, it doesn't come across that way, which is interesting, but the process of writing it was not enjoyable at all. It was so hard, and it was hard for a lot of reasons. It was hard because I didn't know anything about editing or writing a book. I didn't know anything about the publishing world. It's like, it would be like recording a record and then having to learn about the music industry. Like, I did record a CD once and I had no idea the difference between mixing, arranging, composing, you know. Like, you have to learn all the vocabulary. It was really hard because I'd never had any external reflections. I mean, I had the external reflection that the publisher wanted the book. Okay, that was really a big deal, because before that, I was just believing that it was a good idea, but I didn't know that anyone else thought it was a good idea or that anyone else would care. So that was helpful. But then there's such a big gap between that and delivering. I was constantly thinking, they're going to fire me. They're not going to want this. Like, it's terrible. In the first draft, it did get rejected, which I didn't even know that was possible. And I just didn't know anything about how it worked. But also it was because I was not totally out of the difficulty yet. I wasn't really out of the woods. So I was mostly out of the woods, but I was writing about something I didn't have. I was writing about a postpartum experience that I knew existed and that I was vehemently advocating for in every way that I can possibly think of to convince someone that it's important to prioritize, but I didn't have it. Yeah. So I was writing about something that was mildly theoretical in my personal experience. And for my own personal path, experience is what I stand on. I don't have a medical degree. I don't have the credentials that would be the things that would make me credible. So what makes me credible is my own life. And I'm fine with that. Like, I'm actually, like I said, sort of oppositional. So for me, it's like, I don't really care about data and statistics. Like, this is real. And I know it's real because I feel this and I see this and I perceive it. So to me, it's real and it matters. So I wrote that book from a place of it was like retrospection and research. This book, I'm writing from a place of, I know how to do this. Mm-hmm. I've done this. I've taken many people through this. I live this experience. I am a representation of what this is. So in a way, it's more my soul's work because it's more to the essence of what I am. But like I said at the beginning, everything I've ever done is about helping people loosen the binds of, I wouldn't even say, like, it's hard to even have language for it because I don't relate to a lot of language and how it's interpreted. Like, if I said false narrative, like, I don't really believe in that language. So, but if we just say something like essence, you know, that fourth trimester has some very specific elements to it, but essentially it's about personhood and humanhood and like how we can be more human with each other, how we can love each other more, what are the ingredients of caring for ourselves as human animals and remembering that we're animals.
Mm-hmm.
This book is very much the same. And it's funny because when I look at the first book, I think, oh, I'm actually kind of writing the same book. I'm just writing it in a different way for different people. And now more people are going to be able to understand these things because, because I have a bigger publisher, but also because I'm not writing about a specific window in someone's life. I'm writing about principles. So that's exciting to me because I'm glad that I wrote a book on the postpartum time, but I do want more people to know about these principles that to me are elemental in how we really come together, how we understand one another. It's really impactful in terms of things like social media, because when you understand that the social nervous system is our first tier of evaluation of how safe we are, and that we require a sense of connection and co-regulation for that safety, you understand how incredibly pernicious it is to be having these dual tracks or multiple tracks running where we have a perception of connection. And there is connect. I mean, it's not just perception, there's actual connection. But how new that is for our system, not only in scope, because never, ever in the history of humankind have we been able to be that connected with that many people across geography. There's something that's really cool about that. And then there's the body part of it, about how we feel, most people feel more like lonely and isolated than they ever have, which just shows me that that perception of connection and the felt sense of connection are not in alignment. And social media is largely responsible for that.
And I'm thinking, you know, back to your point of you're writing this book that will be more accessible to more people because it's not so specific to pregnancy and birth. I also feel like it's a great partnership text for the fourth trimester because, you know, I'm not going to say this blanket statement that like partners didn't read the fourth trimester, but it's a different dialogue. You know, it would be a very different experience for a partner of a pregnant person to read that versus a pregnant person themselves to read it. And that...
Yeah, I'm not sure how many... I mean, if we gender it a little bit, I'm not sure how many men are going to read the Jaguar book either. We just don't know. But it's also, if you think about what the books are out there on trauma, there are very few written by women. And the mainstream ones definitely aren't written by women. Yeah. I don't know if you know any exceptions, but there are books written by women, but they're not the ones that are on the
that people always name. I can just think of Babette Rothschild's books, but like she's never named. It's always Peter Levine and Bessel van der Kolk.
Right. And Body Keeps the Score is in the top 10 on the New York Times bestseller list, backlisted for like 75 weeks or something. Wow. So the go-to trauma books, and there's not too much on sexuality. I mean, also, I don't know if you found that to be true.
Yeah, and I also took a sexual trauma mini course with Peter and Diane Poole Heller, and it was so interesting. And I actually had another teacher of mine in that course, and it was just really interesting the way that sex was discussed. Like, it was kind of like a moral boundary around it that I found really unapproachable.
I did not take the class, but I have taken an in-class course with Peter on sexual trauma, and I about lost my shit in that too. The thing is, if somatic work is based on health and based on a nervous system that's regulated and functioning, then we actually have to have a working definition of healthy sexuality, or at least anything about sexuality. So if we're just drawing on Freud and we're just drawing on normative definitions of sexuality, with maybe like homosexuality being like, oh wow, we're like really on an edge here talking about homosexuality, and everything else is considered a deviance or considered maladaptive, or that you're working out a trauma because you have this fantasy or because you're into BDSM, it's just so limited and it's very outdated. But so regardless of that, there's really nothing out there written about trauma that includes birth and includes women's sexuality from a woman's perspective. So I don't know how that's going to, I mean, the examples in my book include birth and sexuality, and I don't know, like, that's, I'm waiting for edits back, and it's sort of a question that's in the forefront of all of our minds about the book is how front and center do we want to make that? Basically, my book is supposed to be kind of like a feminist Body Keeps the Score. But at the same time, you know, I have a pretty strong approach. And so, and the book is meant to be something that someone could use on their own to help them selves. Information is helpful, but if it's a somatic approach, then information's not the thing that's going to take someone over that, you know, be able to renegotiate something. So we'll see, but yeah, I mean, when you put the woman part of it up front, then that usually means that a male audience doesn't read it. And so I don't know if my book will be something that is able to cross that gap. We'll see.
Well, and what I have great hopes for in all of this work and the many people who are creating in this way is that, you know, particularly with your book, which, as you described, gives people tools to work on their own over a threshold or through a lot of what feel like obstacles, that enables, empowers a more robust communication with whomever they're partnering with. And so that is right there, like, tremendously beneficial.
There are some suggestions in it that suggest that you do things in partnership, right? Uh-huh. Because, I mean, it's bizarre to write a book about somatic, to write a book and have someone read something. And then, you know, when I'm teaching and I'm teaching online, I can regulate, I can feel other nervous systems. I can regulate the group as I go.
Yeah.
In a book, it's like, it's a big challenge to maintain that flow and not let someone just fall in the pit. But yeah, I mean, people, I guess what I want to say is that there's a lot of, with especially because there's probably a lot of yoga practitioners listening, there's just so much pressure that we have to do everything ourselves and, like, heal yourself and heal yourself first, and then you'll heal your relationship. And the book's not meant to be, like, a substitute, but hopefully there'll be, like, lots of book groups and stuff like that where people are working on this stuff together and talking about it and doing some of the exercises together, because that's like a really powerful place to be able to renegotiate stuff.
That sounds amazing. Give me a copy of that book. I'll start the first book club.
Okay. I'm trying, man. This publishing thing is like a very weird business model. But
well, you have no shortage of things that you're creating and offering, and mostly selfishly, I'm going to close our conversation with the question, because how I met you, I heard a podcast with you and it was like, oh my God, SE, oh my God, sexological bodywork, oh my God, birth work, oh my God, Brazil. Just an odd kind of lots of areas of overlap and appeal. But will you offer bodywork training at any point in the future?
Yes.
I'm happy with that answer. I'm happy with the simplicity of it, the straightforwardness of it. Great. And I will make sure that people know how to find you and get on your newsletter and have access to upcoming courses. This body of work that you are building.
Don't even know what I do.
Well,
except for write a book.
I actually think, I mean, if I can say this, between you and Rochelle Garcia Saliga, I think I mention one or both of you in pretty much every podcast that I've done so far. So I think that people who are at least faithful listeners have some sense, and people who haven't listened before are listening because it's you. So I feel okay about that.
Okay.
We'll make sure they have access to your website and social media accounts, etc. And is there anything else you want to say or announce before we close?
I don't think so.
Do you have kind of a schedule? Is that the right way to ask, schedule for when you offer Jaguar and your money course? I'm certain will be offered again.
Yes. So in January, I'll be offering Mother Circle, which is one of my favorite offerings. It's twice a week and it's practice led, but I do a birth story renegotiation as part of it. And I have Syl Reynolds, who wrote the book Mothering and Daughtering, who's kind of like the fairy godmother of the course.
Mm.
And that course is structured way differently than my other courses, where that one you just, it's $99 and you pay one time and you're just a lifetime member. So we have an ongoing group with that. And there's like 300 people in it or something. Really great, great group. And then February, I'll be offering Jaguar. I think I do Jaguar 3 times a year.
Mm.
And then next year, I'm going to do something that I haven't done so far, which people have been urging me to do, but I didn't want to do until I found the right thing. And so I'm teaching a Money in the Nervous System class right now. I don't actually know if I'll teach this class again, but I'm going to offer a 10-month business mastermind for women. So
awesome.
I'm partnering with one of the people who's been one of my consultants and advisors, and we're going to teach all the elements of it, of a lot of the things we've covered in this conversation, of just like how to know what your lane is and how to know which offers are going to hit and which aren't, and how you structure it and where you start from. And specifically, I'm partnering with Ash Robinson, and specifically she's the CEO, has been the CEO for Fit for Mom, which is the Stroller Strides organization. And she's just kind of like a financial savant and leadership. And she's really in the wheelhouse of like how women do business, mm-hmm. how we make choices about money, how we make choices about and a lot of the things that I've done a mastermind with her 4 years ago when I was in the process of writing the first book. And I just couldn't believe how much my energy coalesced around the times when we were meeting. It was like the days prior already, I would start being so much more efficient because I would just start organizing myself around the bigger questions. So I have a number of people, including yourself, that are in my world that are just at thresholds and could use that level of support and somewhat information, but also just how to know, like how to ask the right questions, how to know when to hire an assistant, how to know when you're spinning your wheels or when you're working towards something bigger, mm-hmm. what to do when you're doing that, just a million questions. But also, like, as women, what we do with power, because I think a lot of our difficulties in business and money is power. We're ambivalent about power. We don't like the way power has been wielded in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not sure we want it. We kind of want it, but we don't know what we'll do when we have it. And we're concerned about that. And we don't like to have more power than other people a lot of times, because we are embarrassed about and ambivalent about privilege and that how, like, what does that mean if we have the privilege? So we're just going to be doing that. So that's going to start probably in March, in February or March. And I'm actually really excited about that, because the last couple conferences that I've gone to, I've met some very powerful women who have incredible ideas, and the amount of money that they want is so small, but they're talking about it like it's so big. And I'm just like, dude, it's crazy. Like, there's so many resources out there. There's so much money in the world. There's so many people that need the services that most of the people I know have. And there's just a barrier about getting there and imagining getting there and knowing what it would actually take and having the connections. So in this course right now, I'm trying to get people just like the basic stuff cleaned up so that we can start some of those bigger conversations and turning a profit. I mean, I know so many yeah. women that are doing incredible work and they're not turning a profit. And, you know, I had tons of people applying for a scholarship for this class. And some of them were very passive aggressive. It was really interesting. Some of them were just outright aggressive, telling me, well, if I got 100 people for my class, I was charging 247, so that means I'm making 24,700, so that's twice as much as they make in a year and all this stuff. And I'm like, well, let's take a step back here, because that's actually, you're just multiplying numbers, and, like, you have no idea what my monthly costs are. You have no idea. Like, obviously, you do need the class because you don't know what costs of doing business are.
Yeah.
And we all do it. We all multiply other people's numbers. And I share my numbers a lot because I think it's fun. And I think that money is fun. And I think that I've gained so much from my friends who've been really open about their numbers, because it's made it concrete and it's made it made me understand, oh, like my friend earns 50 grand a month. That's crazy. I thought only people on Wall Street earn 50 grand a month. Oh, I could do that. Okay. Like, why not? And just realizing that how much of a cap I was putting on things because I was afraid of what I would need to do to manage it at that level. Like, now I'm going to have to work more and then I won't see my kid and all this stuff, which wasn't true. And realizing that the amount of knowledge that I needed was like very minimal, like an hour phone conversation to figure out what to do with more money. So I was like, and then the possibilities of who I can support and the kind of mentorship that I can do without charging and not having to raise my rates for the thing like my session work, because I don't want to raise my rates. I don't want to charge more than I do. Of course, people are like, you can charge this. It's the value. I know all those things, but I have to do what feels comfortable for me. Yeah. And for me, and that's how I decide price points, like what's comfortable, where am I not overgiving, how is this incentivized, and you know, so yeah, I'm excited about being able to offer that, because ultimately I'm working with sexuality and birth, and a lot of women aren't having the births they want because of money. They're not getting a doula because of money. They're not hiring a midwife because of money. They're not getting pelvic floor PT because of money. They're not in relationships that are good because of money. And so I'm like, all right, let's just like excavate a little deeper and get to that.
That's amazing. And I'm signed up. I'm so awesome. Thrilled and I'm so grateful. And just want everyone to receive the wisdom, the work, you know, this conversation is one of many. You, and I heard you say this, you like to be on podcasts and be in these conversations. I feel like you are very generous with your time, but I am super grateful for your time today. And I really adore you. And I think that there are so many people who will glean so much from even this conversation. And then there's so much work that you're offering available. So thank you. On behalf of everyone listening, thank you.
I adore you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today on this episode of the Sacred Body Podcast. Please leave us a review if you have the time. Spread the word far and wide. Talk to you next time.